I'm Russ.
And I'm Shane.
We see the world through the eyes of biologists, conservationists, and bow hunters.
Welcome to the Ecological Approach Podcast.
How's it going, Shane?
Pretty good. How are you, Rusty?
Doing great. Shane and I did a 3D shoot, two days ago?
Sunday, yeah.
Sunday. It was a lot of fun.
3 days ago.
30 targets. They had everything ranging from pheasants to bears, wolves, snarling coyotes, and a full-size moose.
Yeah, the last target was a full-size moose target, which is pretty cool.
That was a lot of fun. It was about 40 yards, I think, on the moose, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was a good thing it's a big target because it was a bit of a stretch with my recurve bow. But
did you ever smoke it on your last shot?
Yeah. Man. Took a couple to zero in exactly. At those longer distances, I can use the point of my arrow to sort of gauge where to aim, and my point on is right at about 45 yards. So
that's handy.
Once I found that out, then I was able to consistently get them in there. But yeah, and it was your first 3D shoot ever. What'd you think of it?
I can't wait for the next one. It was so much fun. It was an absolute blast. And it was funny because the last podcast, we were laughing because you changed your string and you were struggling, but you were just on fire this time. I couldn't believe it. You were giving me a run, and I have a sight and a compound bow. So
Yeah. Well, it wasn't I wouldn't say it was an overly difficult 3D course. Like, most of the shots were, what would you say? Probably average 25,
20, yeah, 22, 23 yards seemed to be most of them.
Yeah, I guess over 30 yards would be a far one.
They definitely weren't consistently spaced, which was kind of fun.
Yeah, but they were tricky though. The sort of the habitat that this 3D shoot was in, a lot of it was like a thicket, very shrubby, really thick, and the lanes towards the targets, they were pretty small and they were cut out of the sort of the thicket, so that can throw off your depth perception. And I never use a rangefinder with my traditional bows, but a lot of people shoot compound use a rangefinder, but you didn't have one either. So we were both it gets tricky. Those, when you're looking down that tight laneway, it makes things look further away. And then you get to another target where it's completely open, and it just makes it look closer. It just throws off your depth perception.
It does, and obviously, having a rangefinder is the optimal thing. But if you don't have, it's nice to be able to guess or estimate ranges with some accuracy too. For those times your equipment fails you, or you forget it, or you just don't have one, it is nice to have some sort of clue how far something is.
Yeah, knowing how to accurately at least estimate a range, and I think you can get pretty darn good out to say 40 yards or so, and then it gets a little bit tougher. But what kind of method do you use to estimate a range? I typically will picture in my mind what 10 yards looks like, and then I'll see how many 10 yards I can fit to get to the target.
That's what I do. I mean, we've talked about our plant surveys before. They're in 10 by 10 meter plots, and we do 100 of these things, 104 or 100, and I think we're up to 110 or something now with those new ones. So, I mean, I'm very familiar with what a 10 meter looks like because that's where our photo monitoring stakes are. So that's what I use in my head. I say, okay, this is about 10 meters because I look at hundreds of these things, and then if it looks like I could fit four of them in there, then it's 40 yards.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of do a conversion from meters to yards.
Meter
as well.
Is touch over a yard.
It's slightly bigger, right?
1.3 maybe, or not even.
I don't know.
I'm not sure either. But
I don't know. But when I double check with a rangefinder, my I'm not that far off. I'm pretty good. So.
Well, I'm glad you had a good time. We've been talking about doing one for a couple of years now, ever since you started shooting, and I knew you'd like it because it's it's a neat setting. You're just walking around in a nice natural area in the woods. There's life-size animal targets. It's just, I knew you'd enjoy it. And it's great, great practice.
Well, there's a little pressure too, because if you miss one, you're throwing your arrow into the woods.
Yeah. Sometimes other people are watching, or your, you know, your shooting partner, they're watching, and, yeah, it puts a little bit of pressure on you, but I think that's a good thing. That's,
I do too.
Simulates some kind of pressure when you're in a hunting situation. And, man, if you've 3D shoot is a great litmus test for how prepared you are to shoot your bow in a hunting situation, because you find out pretty quick if you're not comfortable with different ranges, different size targets, different there's just a lot of variables there, and it really shows if you're even your shooting form and stuff like that. Like it's a great way to judge where you're at coming up to the hunting season, because we're less than 6 weeks away now, less than a month and a half from October 1st.
We're getting there. Yeah, it's coming up quick, not quick enough though, but it is getting there. I like that they had some elevated, so you climb up onto a platform and you do some shots. There were some where the growth was hanging over, you know, sort of right in your line of sight, so you had to get down on a knee. And I like that you had to sort of adapt and work around different situations. That was fun, and I think we both did pretty good. I wasn't disappointed when I left there.
Yeah, that's the first 3D shoot that I've done this year. I mean, I used to do quite a few more. I haven't done that many in the past few years, but the last one I did was last summer, so I haven't done one in a whole year. And even last year, I think I only did two or three. So I was a little rusty as well, but it took a few targets to get into the feel of things, but I was pretty happy with my shooting, considering, like you said, I just replaced my string and I was having some issues there not too long ago. So I spent a lot of time getting things tuned up properly, and it definitely paid off because my arrows were flying perfectly straight, and I was pretty happy with my shooting.
One thing's for sure, when you watch somebody shoot a traditional bow accurately and with skill, it's a really impressive thing to watch, because it almost surprises me that it hits the mark every time, you know?
Well, you're not the only one it surprises. Sometimes it surprises me too, and I'm the one shooting it, because really all I'm doing, I mean, I use some reference points, but for the most part, it's pretty much instinctive shooting, and I'm just looking at the spot that I want to hit. And sometimes when you've got it drawn back and you're just staring at that spot, you have confidence because you've done it before, but sometimes it just enters your mind where it's like, I don't know where this thing's gonna go. You release and it goes right there, and it's a surprise sometimes, but that's just through repetition.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and I gotta say, well done, AMA Sportsman Club in Amherstburg. We had a lot of fun, and we'll definitely be going back again.
Yeah, I can't wait for the next one. I want to do another one, hopefully before season starts.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Shane, how about we hear some sightings from the outdoors? What do you got for us?
This is less of an individual wildlife sighting and more of just like a general observation, but there's always a few things that I see in late summer, and when it's starting to feel like just a touch of like fall is in the air, and I swear it just makes me physically feel different in a way. You know, those hot summer days, they're still hot during the day, but the mornings and evenings are a little cooler. It's less humid. The air is just a little clearer. And I swear I can just feel that late summer vibe in my bones.
The blazing star is done flowering. And
yeah. And a few of those indicators that I've been seeing that I see every year. And it reminds me of this, you know, that hunting season's approaching is, starting to see the very first leaves beginning to change, foliage on some of the trees. And I always notice, I'm not exactly sure why, but the maples, like some of the soft maples that are in wetter, swampier areas like silver maples. It always seems like the ones that are right in water always seem to turn first, start turning first. I'm not sure exactly why that is. But I've noticed some maples in wet areas that are just starting to turn a little bit. I've noticed some of the cottonwood trees are starting to turn a little bit yellow. And, you know, it's not like the whole tree's turning yet, but you get those few that are starting to die and you're starting to see some yellow cottonwood leaves on the ground. And one of the other things is the goldenrod. Goldenrod always starts flowering late summer, early fall, like late August into September. And it's just at that point where they haven't, the majority of them haven't bursted open yet, but it's like they're right about to. You're starting to see them turn yellow. And man, when that time comes, that's
starting
like
to feel.
Like I say, I can feel it in my bones. I don't know if it's an evolution almost kind of thing, or if it's just me being hunting since I was a kid and just associating that in my own mind with what's coming. But man, it's I love this time of year. It's like the anticipation is just
nostalgia gets triggered by all senses. I find sometimes smells, sometimes sights, sometimes sounds, a certain song. So it'll be a combination of all those senses coming together. I get that too. One of the things that I've also noticed at this time of year, that late summer feel to it, is all the plants, including the goldenrods, but just about everything in the grasslands is starting to senesce. It's starting to, die off. They die off, you know, towards this time of year. So, and the bugs have done all their damage. They've had a full season of growing. So they get a little crispy around the edges and you get that crunch when you walk through the grass. We're there.
And it won't be long before the deer, the bucks start shedding their velvet.
Yeah.
It's usually the first ones I usually see are right at the usually first week of September. So we're like,
I saw two nice bucks yesterday, probably an 8 and maybe a 10 point when I was doing some of my surveying, and they were still velvet. They were nice looking bucks on land that we can never hunt because it's in a city, but it was still pretty cool to see them. Obviously, it's always nice to see them.
So what about you? Seen anything, any sightings to,
I got a good one. A friend of mine tipped me off to these Osage orange trees. And of course, you know, Osage orange is a special tree. I don't know if it's native to where we're sitting now, if it's native to Southern Ontario. I tend to think that it's native to the south of us.
Yeah.
I think it's Carolinian species, but, I know the native people hundreds of years ago brought a lot of Osage orange trees up because it's exceptionally good bow making wood. Yep. And these Osage orange trees that a friend pointed out to me a few years ago, it happened that they were growing right on a spot of a new building that was going up. So I got there and it was by total chance that I rolled into this site where these guys are doing the work and they're getting right close to the Osage orange trees. And it turns out that they were removing them. They were slated to be cut down and they were throwing everything in the shredder. They weren't salvaging anything. Like it was mostly just scrub and brush. And even these Osage orange trees, they weren't particularly tall, straight trees. They were a bit ratty how they tend to grow in the open. But I asked if he could save me any lengths that were 6 feet or longer. If he could stack them for me and put them to the side, I'd gladly take them and see what you could do with them. So he did some cutting and he did that, solid move. Thanks. If you're listening to this, thank you for that. But it wasn't an ideal tree. So I grabbed a couple pieces. I wasn't sure that there was really anything usable in there because I don't build bows. I don't know much about it, but I know a guy that does. He's sitting right across from me. So I call Shay. I said, Shane, I got these Osage logs. I don't know if they're going to be any good to you, but what can I do? And so you inform me, like, paint the ends, stop that checking right away. So I did that, painted the ends, and pretty well stored them in my driveway on blocks. Well, Shane came over and to record this, and this is the first time he's seen these logs, and he tells me that they're very usable. So I was really excited that I was able to salvage these logs that were going to headed into the chipper, and you're going to be able to get some staves out of them and make some bows out of them.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. The logs are probably, what would you say, maybe 8 inches in diameter or so?
Yeah, maybe 1/8 and one is maybe a little bigger than the other. So I'd say between 7 and 9, let's say.
Yeah, and they look good. That's big enough. That's big enough to make, when it's split, at least 2 bows per log. And everything looks good on them. Like the nice big growth rings, which makes it easier to, well, we'll get into this, I think, in the podcast, but makes it easier to follow a growth ring, chase down a growth ring if they're thicker, and less of a chance you're going to cut through it, which we'll talk about later on here and find out why that's important. But the grain looks very straight, and you can tell by looking at the bark, you can usually tell if it's running, pretty straight, longitudinally following from the top of the log all the way to the bottom. And then it's pretty straight. If there's no like corkscrew twist to the bark, because if you try and split that, the grain is going to follow that twist in the bark. So that leaves you with a pretty difficult kind of obstacle to tackle to make a bow out of it. That twist is a lot worse than just like a straight bend.
You can work with a bend because you can straighten it,
right?
Or you can steam it, right? That's what you're saying. But with a twist,
with a consistent twist, you basically need to, if you want to get all of the twist out, which ideally you should. If there's a bit of twist in there, it's not a big deal. But you would basically have to heat the whole thing and like clamp it down to a form that's going to straighten the whole thing out. Or you could start at one end, heat it up, and work it all the way down to get that twist out. But it's a lot of work.
It sounds like you're better off starting with an untwisted log.
Yeah.
That sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah.
Well, so, I am just thrilled that you could use this log. And like you mentioned, this is a segue that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about bow making, which is something Shane is quite good at. What do you call a bow maker?
Bowyer.
A bowyer.
Yeah.
Shane's a bowyer, and that's what we're going to talk about today. So, okay, here, this surprised me because the wood is just heavy as lead. It's some of the heaviest wood. There was mulberry growing next to it, which is surprisingly similar looking, and it's also a heavy wood.
Yeah, similar looking heartwood and sapwood as well. It's got that white sapwood and then a yellowish colored wood as well.
Yeah, but so when we... Well, you know, when the guy cut these logs, and I was looking at the, I was expecting really tight packed rings. I was expecting a slow growing tree, but that wasn't the case. Like these trees are packing wood on fast and dense. You know, for such a dense heavy wood, I was really surprised at how wide the growth rings were. I mean, that must be surely part of why it makes such a good bow making wood.
Yeah, the density of it for sure. It's more of the, because there's bow woods that are heavy that don't make good bows, or there's woods that are heavy that don't make good bows. There's woods that are heavy that make good bows, and there's woods that are light that make good bows, and there's woods that are light that don't make good bows. So it's less about the density and more about the individual, like the properties of the wood as far as tension and compression go.
Right.
And tension would be the force that is applied on the bow, the side of the bow that's facing the target. You can think of a piece of wood that's bending. That outer part is under tension, and that inner part is under compression. And different woods have different tension and compression strengths. And Osage just happens to be pretty great in both of those, both aspects. So it's more about those individual properties. But I would say in general, harder, denser woods usually make a better bow than a light wood. There are some exceptions like Pacific Yew There's also a European yew, and that's a pretty light wood, but it makes good bows.
Hmm. It's interesting that the native people figured this out. We like, you know, hunting, but we don't need to hunt. You know, I'm not going to starve if I don't get a deer.
Yeah.
But the native people needed to hunt. So I guess for them, I mean, it was absolutely imperative that they found quality materials to build their hunting weapons out of. But it, you know, that they found the optimum wood. They must have tried every species of every kind.
Yeah, I'm sure. Oh, yeah. I'm sure they would have taken advantage of what's in the area, but Osage was a very popular wood that they would use. So you know that where it was available. And I think actually, if you look into some of the archaeological findings and stuff like that, you'll find that it's not really uncommon for native peoples to trade, right? And you'll find Osage bows pretty far outside of the natural range that Osage would have grown. And also, same thing with rocks, with flint napping. You'll find rocks in certain areas that have been traded and transported from other parts of the country or other parts of the continent.
And someone that knows what they're talking about can easily identify where the deposits of this particular chert might be. Or, you know, I've spoken to somebody like that and showed him some artifacts, and he knew exactly where the material was sourced. And he even mentioned some of that must have been traded in here.
Yeah, those rocks are pretty unique.
Distinctive.
Yeah.
Okay, well, so Osage is the optimum wood for bow making. We talked about mulberry being, I mean, it looks very similar. It feels very similar. Why is it not as good?
Mulberry is a good one. I haven't used it extensively, but I do think it's not quite as good. From what I've read, it's not quite as good, I think, in compression strength. And you may just have to alter the design a little bit. Like Osage being one of the best bow woods, you can get away with sort of a very efficient, minimalistic design that doesn't have any excess wood on it. So it's a little bit more efficient. It's a little faster. It's a little bit of a better design. Whereas some of the woods that aren't, you can still make bows out of them, but you just have to alter that design so that the stress in bending the limbs is distributed properly. So you may just have to, if you have a softer wood or a not as ideal bow wood, you may just have to make the limbs wider or the whole bow longer in order to distribute that stress along the wood.
When you're talking about compression properties and tension properties, you're basically, I mean, it's, you're talking about snapping, right? It's snappy. It's a more snappy wood is really what it comes down to.
Yeah. The tension strength, I guess, would be how far you can bend it without it breaking, without it getting, you know, splintering or breaking. And then compression strength would be how far you can bend that without getting stress fractures in the wood. So it won't often snap on that compression side. It'll usually just bend and it'll stay bent. It won't return to its original shape. So what you want in an ideal bow wood is if it has good tension and compression strength, it's not going to break when you bend it, and it's going to want to return right to where its original shape was. A not so optimal bow wood usually will take more string follow or set, which is once the wood is bent, it keeps a little bit of that bent shape. It doesn't whip back to exactly the shape that it started at. So it basically, it doesn't hold the same amount of energy
forever.
Forever, yeah.
Yeah, I get you. So it almost fatigues over time, like most materials do.
Yeah.
So I think for this discussion, maybe we need to just start at the beginning and go through the process of building a bow.
Yeah.
I think that might be the best way the best way to go about this. So I talked earlier about staves, as if everybody knows what a stave is. I didn't know what a stave was until you told me. Yeah. So what is a stave, and how do you get a stave out of a log?
Well, a stave is just basically just a split. Like if you take a log and you split it into a piece that's the size that you would use to make a bow out of, it's basically what a stave is. It's just a split, long split piece of wood. And however many, depends on how big the log is, to how many bows you can get out of it. If it's like that one, that Osage log, 8 to 10 inches in diameter, I'll be lucky if I can get 4 bows out of that. Like if I can split it into quarters. So if you take that log, split it in half, and then split that half into quarters, one of those quarters is basically a stave. Okay. I guess before we get into the bow making process, if anybody's interested in making their own bow, getting into it, first thing I would recommend is get some good resources. And I mean, I think this is important in anything you want to learn about when it comes to, you know, our line of work, and just, you know, if you want to learn more about plants or how to identify them, you're going to get a good field guide and you're going to get some good resources to be able to properly do that. So I think it's the same thing with this. You need some good resources because it's a bit of an overwhelming process. And if you do your, it's going to take some trial and error, but if you do your research beforehand, you're going to have far less learning mistakes. There's going to be learning mistakes, but hopefully you can reduce them.
And let's face it, we live in the time of information that's so easily accessible. So jump onto YouTube, jump onto Google.
There's some great stuff on YouTube and Google, a lot of great free information out there. But if I had to recommend, the ideal place for someone to start is to grab some books. I think they're available. I think they're still in print and available, but the traditional Bowyer's Bible series, and there's 4 of them, I believe. They're all great, but the first one is pretty much essential reading if you're going to get into bow making. It goes into so much depth about all different bow woods, their properties, how to design a bow, how to alter your design, depending on what species of wood you're using. They do all of these scientific tests, and it's just a great resource. That's where I would recommend to start. There's lots of good books out there, but that's kind of the, I guess, sort of the gold standard of a good place to start. Beyond that, YouTube, there's a lot of great videos on YouTube. Some of them I can recommend are Clay Hayes. He's pretty popular. He's got a pretty popular YouTube channel, and does a lot of stuff with building Osage self bows. Ryan Gill with Hunt Primitive. He's also got a great YouTube page and Instagram and stuff like that. And he hunts mostly with all primitive equipment, like self bows, cane arrows, stone arrowheads, all that kind of stuff. So that's pretty cool to see. Hunts a lot of hogs down south with that equipment. And also Swiftwood Bows. He's got a great YouTube channel, and he's got like a 10-part series going through how to build a bow that's super detailed.
This is a YouTube series?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So great information out there. Do as much research as you can before you get started into it. It just makes the whole process that much easier. And then beyond that, I guess the first step would be sourcing your wood, sourcing your bow wood.
Hang on, I'm going to jump in here. Not surprisingly, Shane, being the modest guy that he is, doesn't even mention his own Instagram page. check that out too. There's all kinds of, I mean, every post is just full of passion, but there's also some footage of you working wood and some of the finished products that you've created. Some some footage of you shooting them and things like that. So that is the art of bow hunting. And Shane, why don't you just spell that out for us so that people can find it?
On Instagram, just art_of_bow hunting. And it's not all self-bow related. It's all bow hunting related, but there's a lot of self-bow building kind of a little bit of info and content on there. So hopefully some people can get some useful info out of that as well. And if you ever have any questions or anything like that, anybody can hit me up on Instagram, message me, and I'm more than happy to answer some questions.
I can promise you they're going to get inspiration from it. If they don't find the information they want, they're going to find inspiration. Okay, so you've got your stave, you've got your log. Let's say you cut it into, you split it into four. Is there a certain way to split it? I mean, it seems to me like splitting a 6-foot log isn't the easiest task in the world, especially when it's some of the hardest wood in North America.
It can be difficult depending on the species and the grain type. It can be really hard. It helps to have the proper equipment. And what I would recommend is just having some steel wedges.
So this is just a standard log splitting wedge that you would buy from any hardware store?
Yeah. Anyone will work. The ones that I got from Lee Valley, and they've got a bit of an offset sort of twist to them. And I like them. They're pretty nice because a straight wedge, as you hammer it in, it can just sort of get stuck because although it is tapered and it is forcing that wood apart, if that wood doesn't break, it ends up just kind of binding up in there. But if you've got a bit of twist to that, it sort of torques the wood open as you're splitting it.
Like it pries it open more, a little more than a straight piece.
Yeah, and I've had good luck with those. But sledgehammer, steel wedge, multiple steel wedges, at least two, makes a big difference. And hatchet, axe comes in handy too. But it really depends on the species of wood that you're using. Osage, I think, is like moderately difficult to split just because it's a dense wood and it has some interlocking grain. It's actually that grain that really determines how difficult it is to split. And something like ash, which makes decent bows. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a top tier bow wood, but it'll make some pretty good usable, hunting weight bows. But it usually has a very straight grain, and it's usually quite easy to split. You get one wedge in there, and it'll start splitting, and you usually only have to put that wedge in every, couple feet or so down the log, and it'll just naturally kind of want to split apart. But if you get something like elm that has a really tight interlocking grain, what I've had really good luck with, and pretty much the only way to split elm to get usable staves out of it, is I'll put a what's called like a kerf cut with a circular saw. I'll just only put it half an inch deep, maybe 3/4, maybe an inch deep, and I'll run that saw directly down the entire length of the piece of wood, and I'll do that on both sides, so that'll give it a spot to start splitting from. And if you're going to do that, you have to be sure that grain is somewhat straight to begin with, because if it's all twisted and you cut through it and you try and split it, then you're not going to get...
I can just imagine the problems you're going to run into. I mean, you're just not running along...
The grain isn't going to run along the whole length of the bow, and it's going to want to split or crack at the spot. It just doesn't... Work. Yeah, not going to work. So you got to be a little careful using a saw. Generally, you want to use things that split, so that it's a lot easier to follow the grain and you're not cutting through it. But what I do is, if I'm sawing it, I'll put those cuts in. If I'm not sawing it, then I'll just start on one end. If your log is beginning to crack already, that's a good place to set your first wedge, because that's just naturally where it wants to split. And
so you're splitting where it's already started to split.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ideally, you don't have a lot of that splitting on the ends. That was the idea of me painting the end, right? Was to reduce the amount of splitting. So what causes that splitting and why do you want to reduce it?
Well, it's just water releasing from the wood, drying out. As wood dries, it shrinks. And if it shrinks too quickly, if water's leaving the wood too quickly and it shrinks too quickly, it's going to split and it's going to crack. And if you've got cracks in your bow, I mean, you just can't really have cracks in your bow. So right. If it cracks, you've got to cut that much more of the your usable bow wood off the end until you're not getting any cracks.
So what's happening is the end wood is maybe dried and shrunk and the interior wood is still wet. And so there, it's just not, I mean, the shrinking is just, it's developing cracks on the ends like that.
Yeah. Those ends will dry out the fastest. And so they'll start to split. And then the way that you prevent that, if you're cutting your own bow wood, is to, like you said, paint the ends. You can use, if you got like a thick paint, I'd put a few coats if you can. But you can use a wood sealer or wood glue, anything that's going to prevent that moisture from coming out is what you're going to want to do. And that'll prevent splitting, prevent cracking. And then you can leave that. If you're cutting your own tree for bow wood and you seal the ends, you can leave that for years if you want. And honestly, it probably won't be fully dried even after those years if you don't split it.
Well, you say you could leave it for years if you want. I'm thinking there must be a minimum amount of time to dry. You don't want to be necessarily make, well, you don't want to make a wood out of a fresh tree because you're going to get that cracking, that splitting, that shrinking, all the things you don't want. So it needs to be a dried piece of wood, like a cured piece of wood. What time frame are you looking at?
Yep, it needs to be dry. And the reason it needs to be dry is because if you have a wet piece of wood, I mean, I'm sure everybody has bent a green piece of wood and bent a dried piece of wood, a branch or whatever. And the green piece, you bend it, it doesn't break, but it stays bent, right? So that you don't want that. You want your wood to snap back to its original shape so that it's storing energy to throw your arrow. If it's green, it's going to bend, it's going to stay bent, it's not going to store much energy in the wood. So yeah, you need it to be dry. As far as a minimum time goes, it really depends on the state of the wood and what you do to it. If you leave it as a full log, like I say, it probably won't be dry. If you left it for 3, 4, 5 years, like it'd take a long time to dry out.
But you want that slow dry because you've painted the end. So that's what you're looking for. Like you really need it to take years to dry.
Well, you don't need to. There are ways you can do it faster. You do risk getting some checks, some cracks. But if you do it properly, then you shouldn't get much cracking. When you split it, And the moisture is released off of, not from the ends, but from the whole length of the wood, it tends to not split as much. I don't know exactly. Or if it does split, then you're usually taking that wood off anyway, so it doesn't really matter if there's really shallow cracks. What you don't want is cracks either on the end or on the outside of the log, which will turn into the back of your bow. And the back of the bow is the side that's facing a target when you're shooting it.
It's funny that the back of the bow is really the front of the bow.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A little confusing.
It can get confusing. But you can slow dry it like that if you have the time. But if you split that log into four, then that's going to reduce your drying time. It might be dry in, I don't know, a year or so, roughly. And then if you want it to dry out even faster, what you can do is you can split that, and then you can take that stave and you can rough it down into like a rough bow dimensions and just leave things a little thick, a little big all the way through. And you can have that dried out actually in probably a few months. Like I say, the faster you do it, you are risking a little bit of potential cracking and checking. But I mean, if you want to work on the bow sooner than five years down the road, then you don't really have another option. So most times you can get it to work out fine. So it all depends. How you're storing the wood. Typically, if you're splitting it into staves, that's going to be pretty stable. It's going to take a moderate amount of time to dry. You're not usually getting a lot of cracking. So that's what most people do. But if you leave it whole, it's going to take a whole lot longer. And if you take even more wood off, then it can go faster, but you're risking a little bit of cracking.
I imagine being a bowyer, I mean, I don't know how many hours do you put into a bow, let's say? I don't know if you even ever counted, but if you just stick a number on it, I'm just curious.
I haven't ever counted, but I would imagine, like, to put a time frame on it, if I were to spend a solid, like, long weekend, I think I could turn out a bow. Like, say, 3 days, I think I could turn out a bow if I was working on it all day long for 3 days.
So, like, let's say 10 hours, so 30 hours in a bow, in a rough bow. And then I know what you got to finesse it and tune it and finish it. And that takes time, too. So, you're talking 60, 80 hours, I would imagine, to get a finished product, wrapped handle, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
You don't want to be spending 60 or 80 hours on a piece of wood that might crack. So I think you really just want to start with an ideal piece of wood, don't you?
You know? If you've got it. And if you're first learning, maybe it's not best to start with. There's a pretty steep learning curve. So there's a good chance that your first bow that you build isn't going to be, it's going to be rough. It's going to be a little crude. And the risk of it breaking is going to be pretty high because, there's certain things like tillering and that we'll get into where it takes some practice. And, if you don't do it properly, it can lead to a broken bow. So starting with a piece that you're not, you know, that attached to might be a good idea. And I did want to go over that too before, like, sourcing your bow wood. Not everybody can go and cut down a tree and use that wood. And a lot of, you know, you can order them and get them shipped, but it's pretty expensive and sometimes not really feasible.
How do you buy bow wood? By the stave? By the log?
Yeah, by the stave.
So what would I be looking at if I wanted to buy a stave of Osage Orange?
It's getting pretty expensive. It's probably at least $150
for one stave.
Well,
the bill is on its way.
Yeah.
So it's a serious investment just before you even start.
Yeah, and that's if you're buying. And I wouldn't recommend, if somebody's building their first bow, I wouldn't recommend buying a nice premium piece of Osage and getting it shipped, like I said, because your first bow is probably going to be, it's either going to break or it's not going to be the best performer, to be perfectly honest. I don't know. Some people might be able to do it, but there's, like I say, there's a pretty steep learning curve. So what I would recommend is if you can't find your own bow wood and you don't want to wait the years for it to dry out, I would recommend going to Home Depot, whatever, going to any hardware store, and you can buy a piece of hardwood lumber that will make a usable bow. And you want to get hardwood. You don't want the pine or anything like that, pine or cedar. Red oak is a popular one, and maple.
What size board are you suggesting here? Like a 4x4?
Well, no, I what are they? Like an inch thick is fine.
But the grains have to be just right.
Well, that's what you have to look for. Yeah.
So it's usually go through the pile and
the rough dimensions for like an oak or a maple bow, you're probably going to want to get something that's at least 2 inches wide, and it doesn't have to be that thick, but I would say roughly an inch thick. And then you can overlay another piece of wood at the handle section to make a deeper handle.
Right, because the handle's not really taking a lot of strat. I mean, it's not moving like the limbs are.
No, it's not bending at all. Well, it depends on the design of your bow. You can have a bow that bends through the whole section with no stiff handle, or you can make a stiff-handled bow. But that, I think, is a good place to start. Number one, because it's pretty inexpensive buying a board. And also, it's readily available. Like, if you mess one up, you're not going to have to go find another tree to cut down. It's like you could just run to the hardware store and get another piece of wood.
And it's dry.
It comes dried. It's really important to pick out a quality piece of wood that's going to be good for bow making. And what I look for is the grain needs to be very straight. It needs to be running from, ideally you want to see the grain starting at one end of the wood and running all the way down to the other end of the wood. You don't want to see grain running off the side of the wood.
So a piece that might make a nice furniture isn't the piece that's going to make a nice bow. You don't want that nice, cut across the grains like you see on fine furniture and things like that. You don't want to see that. You actually don't want to see any grain at all. Almost you want it, your cut to be perfectly between rings.
Yeah. So if you're looking for a piece of quality bow wood, you're going to want the grain. If you look down the side of the piece of wood, the side of the lumber, not the widest part, but the thick, if you're looking at the thickness of the wood, you want to be able to see that growth ring basically from one end, and you should be able to see it follow all the way to the other end of the bow. You don't want to see any runouts, because if the grain, the growth rings are running out of the wood, you see them going towards the edge. Well, if you bend it, the first place it's going to break, if there's any stress, is along that part that runs out of the wood. It's just...
So if you're looking at, let's just say for the sake of just clarification, you got a 2x4, you're looking down that 2-inch side, and you want to see straight lines from end to end. You don't want to see any lines run off of that piece of wood.
Exactly. And the growth rings should ideally be parallel to the wide part of the wide part of the lumber. Does that make sense?
So you want consistent grain, consistent spacing in the rings, and straightness.
Yeah, I mean, and look for a nice straight piece of wood. Yeah, you usually have to pick through a whole pile of them to find the best one.
Yeah, certainly that's not, you don't get a stack of those. There might be a couple in a bundle even, maybe.
Yeah. So, but that's a very important step. Look for your starting off point should be a good piece of wood, and it's worth it to take the time and find a nice piece. But I think that's a great spot. That's a great way for people to start, especially if they're just getting into bow making, because like I said, it's cheap, it's readily available, and if you mess it up, you're not going to be that upset.
Well, I think what we should do is when this podcast goes out, we should put some pictures on the Instagram page. I think pictures speak 1,000 words. And
yeah, definitely.
And that would show nicely in a good photo, I think.
Yeah. So you can either cut your own wood and dry it out. You can buy a stave online, or if you have somebody locally that can get you a stave, that's even better. They even have from places like Three Rivers Archery, you can buy just like what's called a bow blank. And that's basically a refined stave that all it takes is you sort of refining the dimensions and doing the tillering. And it just makes it a little bit easier. Or you can get this hardware store lumber. And actually, another thing you can do that I've never done it, but I've seen other people do, is actually get two axe handles, because they're usually made from hickory, which is a nice hard wood that makes pretty good bows. And what you can do is you can splice those two handles together, because they're usually not long enough, in the middle. Right at the handle, you can splice them together and you can get a usable bow out of two axe handles, which is kind of neat. So those are your options for how you're going to source the wood. I don't know what you want to sort of follow through with this, sort of this whole podcast. I guess I can kind of relate it to all of them because it's a similar process.
Well, so we've got our wood. We've talked about some of the good tree species, the length, the aging, the curing, what to look for. What? Okay, so you've got the perfect piece of wood. What do you do with that? Are you, like, I mean, you got to find the bow in there, right? As they say.
Yeah.
So.
And there's a different bow in every piece of wood. It's not just like there's rough sort of dimensions you can go off of, but there isn't one template you could stick on every piece of wood and get that design out of every.
Well, I'm thinking you're not sticking the bow on a bandsaw and cutting a bow out of it, right?
No,
you're talking then, you're chasing rings. You are literally, you do not want to cross a ring. Your entire 6 foot length of bow, well, you know, so I guess 62 inches. You start with a 6 foot log, but your bow is going to end up being somewhere in the 62 inch range. But you can't cross a ring, so that's fine work. What are you using to do that?
Main tools I use are a draw knife. I sit on a shaving horse.
What's a draw knife look like?
A draw knife is basically, let me think here. It's a blade with a handle on either end, and you can either clamp your bow wood or you can have it in a shaving horse. And what you do is you pull that blade. That blade is facing you, and you're holding the handles on either side, and you're pulling that blade towards you, and it's taking a wood shaving off. It's a great tool. You can use it for fast wood removal, or you can use it for very delicate, fine stuff. But I use that a lot.
I saw a post on your Instagram and you talked about this draw blade that you had. You were very happy with it. It was an older piece. What could you talk about what brand or what make that is?
That one is made by A Bowyer. A-B-O-W-Y-E-R. They actually make really nice broadheads. Those are the broadheads that I shoot. And I think they just made a limited number of these for somebody else, and I bought it off somebody else. I don't think they make them anymore. But to be honest, most people that – it's not all that popular of a tool these days. It was used a lot.
It's not all that popular of a craft.
No, but it was used a lot for, it was used a lot probably anywhere from, you know, 50 to 100 to years ago or to even more than that to make furniture, make all kinds of different things.
Before power tools, it was probably in high demand.
Yeah. So
maybe a lot of these things are older.
Yeah. That's where most of them come from. Most people find them at antique shops, yard sales, you know, stuff like that. And they're actually usually better quality, those older ones, as long as they're in good shape. They used to make things that are much better steel and stuff like that than they do now. I've got an old one that was my grandpa's, and I try to actually, I think it was his, but then I think it was actually his dad's or something like that. So it's an old draw knife, but I tried to sharpen that thing with hand tools, just with like a file. And I couldn't even get the file to bite into that steel. It was so hard. Like
so
that just slick, you know, that feeling
carbon
you're trying to bite
steel?
Into. Yeah, high carbon steel. I ended up taking a grinder to it and to kind of refine the edge. And you can tell if something has a really high carbon content, if steel does, when you grind it, the color of the sparks that come off of it. Darker sparks, like darker orange type sparks, is usually like a lower quality steel, less carbon, softer steel, and there's just less sparks that come off of it. And if there's a lot of sparks that come off that are like a really white, bright, that means it's pretty high carbon steel. And those that's exactly what it was. It was
so it's holding an edge for a long time, but when it comes time to sharpen it, you've got a task in front of you.
So I just want to one more thing. You said we went over some tree species that make good bow woods, but there's a few others that we didn't go over, and I just quickly want to go over those before we move on. So it depends where you're located, but around us, around a lot of the Eastern Canada, Eastern North America, some of the popular stuff is Osage, which grows in southeastern United States, a little bit south of us. Yew is a good one that grows out west and in sort of the temperate rainforests on the west coast.
Yew is an evergreen for anybody that doesn't know what that is.
Yep. Y-E-W. What are some other ones? Elm. Elm is a very good one. White elm is preferable to red or slippery elm. Ash will make a decent bow. Hickory is another great one. Hickory tends to hold on to its moisture a little longer than some of the other ones, but it's a good wood. Black locust makes... I've never made a black locust bow, but apparently they make very good bows. What else? A lot of the hardwoods. Maples, like a hard maple you can use. Oaks, a lot of the oaks. White oaks, red oaks. They make good bows. Ironwood. Ironwood is a great one, and that grows throughout actually a lot of Eastern North America. And I made a couple bows out of ironwood, and I was super impressed with that wood. Like, just dense wood and just great bow making properties. Like, it took virtually no set, which I said earlier is when it bends and stays bent, that stuff just springs right back to its original shape. And no issues with tension or compression strength, no issues with, you know, anything breaking or anything like that. I've just been really impressed with that wood.
Rings spaced nice, they're workable?
They're actually usually quite tight, very, very tight rings. But I guess what we didn't really touch on this, but some woods are white woods where they just have one consistent wood all the way through. And they're usually just referred to as white woods. And examples of those would be elm, hickory, ash, stuff like that, ironwood. And those, you don't need to chase a growth ring. All you do is take the bark off, and that right underneath the bark is the back of the bow that you can use. So it automatically will follow one growth ring because it's right underneath the bark.
Well, that's interesting.
Whereas the heartwoods, usually that... what's described as a heartwood usually is a different color or density of wood in the center of the tree as opposed to the very outside of it. So if it's a heartwood, a lot of times you have to get rid of that sapwood, that lighter sapwood, and then you want to use that harder, more dense, darker heartwood. So those species you have to actually take down and chase a ring. So those ones, it makes it easier if you have wider growth rings. But the other ones, it doesn't matter. And actually, I found almost the smaller the rings, it seems like the wood is growing slower, so it's growing more densely. And I think tighter growth rings in the white woods is actually preferable.
Maybe a white wood would be better suitable to a beginner bow maker.
Yeah, I think so. Then you don't have to chase that ring down, which is quite a difficult process if you've never done it before. So some examples of heartwood species are Osage, Mulberry, Black Locust.
Hickories.
Yeah, well, hickory you can use. It does sort of, some of them do have a little bit of a different colored wood in the middle, but you can use the wood right underneath the bark with hickories. So...
Have you tried, or do you know what if black walnut makes a good?
I've never tried it. I've heard it's mediocre.
Okay, it seems like there's a lot more suitable wood than I thought. And folks listening, I really don't know much about this, so I'm asking and I'm learning as I go here. I've all I know about bow making is what I've seen on Shane's Instagram page.
And it gets tough for me explaining because it is such a, man, it's a learning process, right? It's taken me years and years and years. Like I've built my first bow when I was probably, I don't know, like 16, maybe even earlier than that. And it took me a long time to learn all the ins and outs and the little nuances of you know, these kinds of things where it's easy for me to overcomplicate or get into the weeds in this kind of stuff. And maybe people won't be able to follow exactly what I'm saying. So it's good to have you here to make sure that things are making sense and I don't go too deep down any rabbit holes.
Well, it's pretty obvious to me that it's a craft that it takes years. It takes a lot of passion. It takes a lot of effort. If I were going to start making bows, probably the first thing I would do is I would shoot traditional bows. That would be step one for me. But I would talk to people like you, but I would also jump on to the resources we were saying before, yeah. YouTube and things like that. And then your own experiences, you know, you break a couple of bows and you're going to learn quick why they broke and what, you know, why you wouldn't use that wood or do whatever you did like that again. So it's just one of those things that takes a long time to master. And, it's an art. It's sculpting. It's a really difficult art to do. And I got great respect for you for taking it as far as you have.
One of the things that I really like about it is, like we were talking earlier, you don't just have one template that you can use for every bow. Every single bow is completely different, and every bow, you need to read that individual piece of wood and follow that grain, and you need to find the bow in the wood.
Yeah, the wood is going to determine your plan. Exactly. You're not going in there with a plan. You're going to examine what you're working with and then come up with a design and an idea from that.
Yeah. So I think we got a little distracted there. But we did. Okay, some of the tools, I just want to finish quickly on some of the tools. So we talked about the draw knife. A hatchet is good to have, nice sharp hatchet, rasps of maybe, it's nice to have at least two different sort of coarseness of rasps, one really coarse one and one a little bit finer one.
So a rasp is a file.
Basically. A rasp is, yeah, a file made for wood. So it's just a little bit bigger teeth, faster material removal than a typical file that you'd use for metal. And then beyond that, a scraper is really nice to have. And you can use like a cabinet scraper. People use them to flatten, get a really flat surface on cabinets. But it's basically just, you can get them in different shapes, but it's basically just a rectangular thin piece of steel. And it's not sharpened to a point on the edges, but it's basically flattened so that you get a little bit of a burr on either side of the steel. If you were to take the narrow side of that flat piece of metal and just squish it down, it would sort of mushroom out on either side, right?
Yeah.
And those little lips are just enough to catch the wood, where if you run it along, it's going to create like a thin ribbon of wood as you scrape it along. So that's really important for the tillering process, which is basically getting your limbs to bend, which we'll talk about. And then just sandpaper. Yeah, that's about it, really. The nice thing is you don't need any fancy power tools, expensive stuff, all of it's hand, you can do it all with hand tools and it's all pretty inexpensive, especially if you find it at places like garage sales and stuff like that.
But you, like you said, a lot of these tools aren't really in use anymore. So yeah, it's nice that you're using primitive tools, but at the same time, it's not going to come easy. You're going to have to do a bit of hunting around and searching for some of these things.
Yeah. So from there, we've got your tools, you've got your piece of wood, whether that's a board, whether that's a stave, From there, you're going to move on to laying out the bow design on that piece of wood. And it's there's so many different designs out there. A lot of them come from archaeological finds, historical designs that native peoples have used for, you know, thousands of years. But a lot of it depends on what bow wood you're using and whether you're putting any backing on the bow, anything like that. But generally, you know, somewhere in the 62 to 72 inch range is it's about typical length for a self bow, and depending on the wood species, anywhere from Osage is because it's such a good wood, I make it about an inch and a half wide, whereas some of the not so high quality woods or a board you would get from the hardware store, they can be upwards of like 2 inches or over 2 inches wide. So you're going to lay out that design and you're going to want to follow the grain of the wood. And if the wood does a big bend and comes back in, then you're not going to cut through that grain to make the bow limb straight. You're going to follow that, the shape of that grain. So you're going to retain that curviness in your limbs.
Which I think is beautiful. I think that adds so much character. I know. I mean, a self bow almost needs to have a little wave in it.
Yeah. And that's essential. You know, it's not even just for looks, but if, like I say, if you were to cut through that grain, that's exactly where your bow is going to break. It's even though it looks like it's not as, doesn't look right, you know, just to, especially to somebody who's looking used to seeing other bows that are so perfect and so straight. And everything, it doesn't look right, but that's pretty much the only way to do it, to get a successful bow out of a curvy piece of wood. And if you look up, anybody that's interested, if you look up, people usually call them snaky bows. If you look up snaky self bow, I'm sure you'll get lots of different cool image results on Google.
Interesting. I want to Google that tonight. So, the design of the bow, is this, and you say it's sort of being dictated by the wood. So let's say you're down to the point now where you've shaved off some wood, you've got a rough bow, and it's time to really refine it into the final shape. Do you have, could you draw it on and then go from there? Do you have blanks? Do you have plans? I mean, how do you decide what the design is going to be? And then how do you implement that? How do you make that onto a piece of wood?
How you decide on this design is going to be a mix of trial and error and designs that you can find in resources such as that traditional Bowyer's Bible book. And if you haven't made many bows, that's basically how you're going to need to have to start. You're going to have to use someone else's sort of recommended design. But I just draw it right on the back of, right on the wood. Usually the first process, I guess, if you're working with a stave, I'll take the bark off. And if it's a white wood, I'll take the bark off and I'll just draw that design right on the wood, right underneath that bark. If it's a heartwood, like Osage, what you need to do is you need to get that entire back of the bow, which is the side facing the target, if you remember, and the side facing you when you're shooting your bow is the belly of the bow. So you need to get that back of that bow down to one growth ring if you're using a heartwood. So what you need to do is you need to look at that Osage, you need to look at the growth rings on the end of the stave. You want to pick out a fairly wide one so that if you do make a little bit of a mistake and you gouge into that growth ring a little bit, hopefully it doesn't go through the whole thing. And hopefully, because if you do cut through that ring, that's the spot that it will break. But the good thing is if you cut through to a ring, you can always just go to the next ring underneath it if you mess it up. So
the first step is to find the back, because you don't want to be cut in the, into the belly and then have to take more than you thought because you accidentally cut through a ring.
Right. So the very first thing you want to do is get the back of the bow exactly where you want it. And once it's worth, it's a little bit of extra work. Like if you take the whole stave down to that one growth ring, because that whole thing isn't going to be your bow. You're still going to remove a lot of material from that point. But you can see the back of your bow and what's there a lot clearer when you take the whole stave down to that growth ring. So you can, you're able to design and lay out the bow better if you take that whole stave down to the growth ring. Whereas, as opposed to narrowing down the whole profile to the shape of your bow first before you chase that ring, well, you might find out that underneath those few growth rings, you might have like a knot or something there that shows up that doesn't show all the way through. And you could have potentially avoided that if you left it full width, taken it down to the growth ring and then worked it from there. So, yep, get the back prepared, get it on the growth ring that you want, and then lay out the design of the bow.
All right, so you're down. So let's say you've got down to that point now, and you're happy with it. It's time to string it up, and tune it and make it a usable piece of equipment. What do you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's this is actually the most important process in building the bow is the tillering. And what that is if you can imagine, you've got your piece of wood down to the growth ring that you want, you're looking at the back of the bow, and you're going to make an outline of you're going to draw an outline of your of the shape of your bow. So you're going to be, you know, narrow it in at the handle section. It's going to be a little wider throughout most of the limb. And then once you get towards the tips, you're going to narrow it down again, right? So you're going to do a lot of that. Leave yourself a little bit of space. Don't take it down to the exact dimensions right away. Leave yourself a little bit of a buffer space. But you're going to basically, if you're looking at the back or the belly of the bow, it's going to look like a bow. You can see the shape of it. But if you turn it to the side, it's still just going to look like a full with a full thickness log, pretty much. So what you need to do from there is you need to reduce the wood on the belly side. You're never taking wood off of the back of the bow because we've spent all that time making sure the back of the bow is pristine on one growth ring. So you don't want to take any wood off of that side. So any wood you're taking off from this point forward is coming off of the belly side of the bow. And the two things that you're trying to do while you're taking wood off the belly side is there's two sort of main goals. One is to have the limbs bending evenly so that the stress is distributed across the wood, because if you take too much wood off in one spot, that's going to create what's called a hinge, and it's going to bend too much in that spot, and that's where it's going to break if it is going to break. So and then the other thing is getting it down. The other goal is getting it down to the draw weight that you want it. So you're kind of thinking of those two things and balancing them as you're taking wood off. You want it them to bend evenly, but you want to have the proper draw weight as well. And obviously, the more wood you take off, the less the draw weight is going to be because that wood is going to be thinner.
So obviously you can't go into this. This is an incremental process and you need to measure the draw weight and look for, you know, make sure everything's good. You don't have any of these hinge spots and so forth. And then, I need to fix this here. You go and you shave a little bit, you string back up, test it all again. Oh, and then, so you're constantly going, you know, just tweaking.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very slow process. And this is where you're going to take the most care in your bow building, because what makes a good bow, apart from a, you know, not so good bow, is the tiller. So you want to go very slow. So generally, you know, you can, especially the more bows you make, you know what thickness that wood is going to be. So you can do some pretty quick removal with a hatchet or a draw knife until you get down to where the limbs are going to start to bend. And that's called floor tillering. So you're going to take a piece of wood that doesn't bend at all because it's so thick. You're going to remove wood a little bit faster until you get it to just bend slightly. And the reason it's called floor tillering is because you put the one tip of the bow right on the ground, a hard surface. You hold it at the handle and you put some pressure into the handle and you'll start to be able to feel it bend just a little bit. And that's your starting point. And from there, that's when it starts into a pretty slow process. And the way you do that is you put the bow on a tillering stick or a tillering tree, and it's just a piece of wood that holds the bow so that you can draw it, and you can either leave it drawn, you can pull it down, you can put a long string on it and pull it down and leave that string in one of the notches so you can take 10 steps back and you can see how the limbs are bending from a little bit of a distance to make sure that they're bending evenly.
So it's just a visual check. There's not some sort of caliper.
No. A lot of it is by visual. A tillering tree is what I use, and it's very useful because what you do is you don't pull the bow down and just look at it when step back and look at it when it's fully bent. What you do is you actually, there's a pulley with a string going through it and a hook going to on your bowstring, and you step back and you pull that rope and it goes through the pulley so it draws your bow, and you can pull it back and forth so you can actually watch the limbs bending as you're pulling it back and forth. And that helps a lot because especially if your wood isn't perfectly straight, it's very hard to be sure that it's bending evenly throughout that whole thing. Because you can imagine if you've got sort of a recurved portion, even though it's bending evenly, it might still look like it's not because it'll still have that dip in it. But when you can pull it on that tillering tree, you can actually watch it bend. I hope all this is making sense because it's a difficult process to sort of explain.
You're talking 20 years of experience in an hour and a half, yeah, or whatever, however long this podcast goes. So yeah, this is a skimmer.
Yeah.
And it might not make sense to a lot of people. But I think, it's such a unique and cool skill. We had to talk about it.
Yeah.
It's something you have to talk about, and it is technical stuff. I mean, absolutely. It's hard to visualize this, but we're going to have to put some pictures up so people can check it out too.
Yeah. And what I don't want is for people to feel intimidated by this process, because at the end of the day, all it is taking a stick, piece of wood, putting a string on it and hoping to shoot an arrow. It doesn't have to be a refined, perfect bow, right? And most times your first ones won't be, but... And it doesn't have to be, a bow that you use for hunting. But if you can just build a bow, the satisfaction you get out of it, of just shooting an arrow, even if it shoots it at, 80 feet per second and only goes 40 yards, it's still fun to do. It's fun to shoot, and it's a satisfying process. So, anybody out there, don't be intimidated by this process. Just get into it and just try it. And if you make a crude bow, which you probably will for the first time, it's still satisfying. It's still fun. You still learn a lot. It's fun to shoot, even if you just shoot stumps or shoot targets with it,
And just take your time. I'm an artist myself. I've done quite a bit of drawing and sketching, and people often say, "Oh my God, that drawing's great. I could never do that." And I follow that up with, "Have you ever spent 20 hours on a drawing?"
Yeah.
Try it. You do your absolute best, spend 20 hours on it, and then show me what you got, because that's what it takes. It takes time and patience. And sometimes I just can't look at it anymore, and I got to leave it alone for a week and then come back. And then I look a week later and think, man, that's way off. What was I thinking? You come back with a fresh perspective.
Yeah, that's important to do with tillering, because it can really trick your eyes sometimes. When you look at it for too long, you think, "Oh, is that bending evenly all the way through?" And then it is good. If you start to feel overwhelmed or you don't quite know, put it down, sleep on it, come back to it the next day, and just go really, really slowly. Like I said, once you've got it so that it's roughly bending, that's when you're going to start using like your rasps and scrapers. I pretty much only use a scraper and sandpaper for the final tillering because it's very small amount of wood removal.
At that point, it's almost just finishing it. I mean, the amount of wood removal with sandpaper is going to be almost irrelevant.
Yeah, it makes a difference though. And another thing is to bend your wood as you're removing wood before you put it on that tillering tree to find that final tiller. Bend the wood a whole bunch of times. Do it, either draw it with a string, or if you're floor tillering, bend it against the floor. But it takes a while for that wood to fully react to all of that wood that you've removed. So if you have a stiff spot in your limb and you need it to bend more, if you scrape some wood off, the first time you bend it, it might not actually show how much bend is going to be there, or it might not show fully where you're at the first few times, because that spot is still going to be stiff. But if you bend it 20 or 30 times, get it used to bending, then it's going to show a more accurate, because you can get into a situation where you take off wood, it still looks stiff. You bend it once, it still looks stiff. You know, you bend it once more, still looks stiff. And then you put it back up on the tillering tree and you find out you've taken too much wood off, because it takes a while for that wood to react to the removal of it.
That's interesting. I never would have thought of that. So what, like we were talking at the very beginning about, I don't know, I use the word fatigue, whether it's the correct word or not, I don't know, but how wood loses its memory over time. What you want a little bit of that to have started during the tillering process.
Yeah. Otherwise it's just not giving you an accurate representation of the tiller.
Sure.
It'll change. If you don't work that wood a little bit, you might be surprised where after you shoot the bow 100 times, it might end up developing a hinge or something in a spot if you don't properly work in the wood as you're taking wood off. One other really important thing to keep in mind when you're tillering is you don't want to overstress the wood. So if you want a 50-pound bow, the best way to go about tillering, and what you should do is you should never have that bow, that piece of wood, pull more than 50 pounds if that's your target final draw weight. Because what you're doing is you're overstressing that wood, and you're stressing it more than necessary, and it'll probably take more string follow or more set or more fatigue, like you were saying, if you overstress it in the beginning. So if you have a thick piece of wood that's not bending as much as you need it to yet, what you'll do is you'll string up the bow with usually like a long string, and you'll pull it to however far brings you to 50 pounds. So if that's only 10 inches of draw length, pull it to 10 inches. And if it's at 50 pounds, stop right there and remove more wood. Get it bending evenly so that it's easier to remove wood as you go, but get it bending to 10 inches at 50 pounds. Remove a little bit of wood, even if you know, fix your tillering issues if there are issues, if there's stiff spots or hinges, fix those as you go, but take more wood off and then bend it again. And if you can bend it to now 15 inches at 50 pounds, well, you're getting close. A typical draw length is about 28 inches. So never pull it beyond that 50 pounds, but just pull it to the draw length that gets you to 50 pounds. And then the more wood you take off, the further you'll be able to draw it to get to that 50 pound draw weight.
So we got the bow, got it where you want it. You've done it, you know, you've spent your hours on it, tillering it and getting it just right. And it's time to string it up. I know you use little pieces of antler to hold the string. Talk about that.
Yeah, those are optional. They serve a purpose of keeping the string on the tips of the bow on the nocks.
It seems like you're spreading the stress of the, when you're drawing. I mean, that's got to be a good thing on wood. Why would you want all that stress in one little spot the size of a string when you can spread it out over, let's say, an inch.
Yeah, it helps. It's just like a really hard material that spreads the stress a little bit and allows you to make narrower knocks, which make your bow perform better, because the less material, the less mass there is out at the knocks, the faster it's going to shoot, because that is the part of the limb, like the very end of the limb where the string knocks are. That's what's moving furthest in the air when you shoot, right?
So that antler is reinforcing probably the weakest part of the bow, because it's the thinnest part of the bow potentially, and it's the part where the strings attach. So it's actually quite a functional piece.
Yes, but you don't have to put them on. A lot of people just file the knocks. Oh, that's one other thing, that a tool that is pretty much required for bow building and specifically for filing the knocks is like a round chainsaw file. And all you do on those with that is you file out a groove on either side of the bow limb at the very tip, so that your string, a spot for your string to sit on.
What do you use to, I mean, it's a glue, it's some sort of glue. What is it exactly that you're gluing?
Yeah, I've used Tight Bond glue is a good one. Tight Bond 3 is like a waterproof wood glue that works well. Some people use epoxy. I've even heard of some people just using super glue, and apparently it works quite well, but I've never used super glue.
And the handle?
Handle is just going to be it's going to be just your whatever wood you're using.
I guess I should have called it a grip rather than a handle.
Grip, yeah. Well, the actual handle, if you're using a stave, you would just keep that area thicker. If you're using a board bow, like we were talking about from the hardware store, then I would typically glue, laminate another piece of wood on that handle just to make it a little bit thicker if you don't want it to bend throughout the handle. So, string material, you want something, it's probably best to either, like I make my own strings with like a large spool of string material, Dacron or Fast Flight. Fast Flight is generally better because it's the lowest stretch, and you don't want any stretch in your string. I think a lot of people, when they think of a bow, if they're not really well versed in archery, or you know, haven't shot a lot of bows, I think they think that the string stretches, and that's what shoots the arrow.
Well, a slingshot does that, so they're probably thinking along the same lines,
right? But you actually want a string that has the smallest amount of stretch possible. You want the most static string that that you can find, and a lot of these bowstring materials have like zero stretch to them. So what that does is that forces all of that energy to come from the limbs, and having no stretch just really makes the limbs snap back into place, and it just creates a more efficient bow with a static string. So if
it's one less variable, you know, playing into your shot too. You know, you've got stretch, it's going to affect everything. It's just, you know, you've tillered your bow to be exactly to the point you like it. Why would you want the string to interfere with that? You know, I could see why you'd want a consistent, stiff, no surprise kind of deal.
Yeah. So buying a bowstring, especially if you're first starting out, is probably the easiest way to go. But if you can, I mean, if you're not that worried about it, like I say, if it's your first bow and it's fairly crude, you can just find a piece of probably, you know, the lowest stretch, even like paracord type material or something like that. You can use it in a pinch. It'll work. But if you want to make a more refined bow that is going to shoot to its full potential, you want a really low stretch string material.
Cool. And then, so, I mean, that's a bow, right? And then it's, you got to just tune it, and you got to do your string twists until you get the everything just right. And
yeah, you basically have a bow at that point. I mean, there's some refining to do, sanding, stuff like that. But that tillering process is really, it's hard to explain over audio, you know, the complete process in detail, but that is what you should really be focusing on, being sure that you're tillering. And that's going to ensure that your bow isn't going to break as well. That's going to make sure you've got a bow that'll last years and years of use. So, yeah, and once it's built, I mean, people have been using self bows for thousands of years to hunt animals. So, if it's built properly, they're more than capable of taking big game, small game, whatever you want to use. But, I wouldn't recommend, at least for most people, you know, expecting to be able to hunt with a self bow, especially if it's your first one you've built. You know, get some under your belt, and even a refined self bow still isn't going to be able, it just simply can't hold up to a modern day, you know, aluminum CNC'd riser, recurve riser and carbon limbs and all that kind of stuff. Like it's going to shoot a little more crude too, you know, like your effective range might be shortened with a self bow, but they are capable of hunting and taking big game for sure. So things like the size of deer. I know a guy, an older guy that I bought a lot of my staves off of, and he shot a moose with his self bow. And so they're definitely capable weapons. But you know, your first few, if you're just getting into it, just try to have fun with it.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, people have been using self bows for a lot longer than they've been using anything with fiberglass or carbon fiber or aluminum.
Yeah.
Like you said, thousands of years people have been shooting them, and they've been catching dinner with it. So
yeah,
they work.
And I'm trying to convince you to try to build a bow out of some of that Osage that you grabbed.
And I'll probably do it.
Yeah. And it'd be fun to work on one together.
I'm not going to lie. I wouldn't do it if I didn't have you to, you know, talk to, well, basically to walk me through it, to help me out where I needed it. But you definitely inspire. I'm going to give it a go. I'll give it a try. Check it out. I mean, I don't expect much, but at the end of the day, I'll at least have a new bow hanging up on my wall, even if it doesn't get a lot of use.
Yeah.
You know, shoot some hay bales out in the backyard and that.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Sometimes you wrap the handles. That last one you wrapped was beautiful.
Yeah, you can use anything really. I mean, you don't even have to wrap it. You can just, I guess we didn't really talk about how to finish them, but as far as a finish goes, you just want to use like a waterproof wood finish. So most exterior varnishes and things like that will be fine.
I'm thinking a soft finish as opposed to a hard varnish, right? Like you're talking an oil type finish.
No, you can use hard finishes.
And it doesn't crack with the flexing of the wood and things like that?
No. Polyurethane, I use a lot, either wipe on or they come in a spray can. I think that is a fairly flexible finish as far as, you know, hard finishes go. But that's a good one, polyurethane, because it's waterproof. And Helmsman spar urethane is also a good one. But you can use tung oil. You can use, you know, if you want to do more natural stuff, linseed oil, true oil, which is like a gunstock finish. And then a primitive finish that a lot of native, you know, people historically would use is grease fat, animal fat, typically like bear fat, because it was, well, probably more abundant. Bears are pretty fatty, but also it just, I think, repels moisture pretty well. So they would heat it and get it, soak it right into the wood, and probably add additional layers sort of all the time as you go.
I had a Mossberg 410 shotgun, and it had a shiny glossy finish on it, which I didn't like, because I just, the sun hits it and it shines, and I just wanted to get rid of it. So I took it apart, I sanded it down, got it right down to the wood, and then I finished it with mink oil. And it worked, which you use, usually you'd use that for leather, but I just thought I'd use it for this gun, and I never had a problem with it. It was great. It looked beautiful. It was great. I mean, it changed the gun's look completely. Looked beautiful like that.
And then handle wraps. You can leave it. You don't need to wrap the handle, but I guess it's a mixture of aesthetics and just comfort, something nice to hold in your hand that grips well. Really popular one is leather, just because it's pretty durable. It's just been used for, like I say, a long, long time. But yeah, any leather will work. But I've my past few bows, I finished them with a beaver tail grip. And it's just like a tan piece of beaver tail. And that works really great. Not only is it super tough, it's also water resistant because, beavers being an aquatic animal, their tails just naturally repel water. So that's a good one to use.
I think they look the nicest, beaver tail.
Oh, they look beautiful.
They really do.
Yeah. So is there any other... anything that, specific questions that you can think of that we missed, or any parts of the process that are unclear to you or anything like that?
There's a lot of questions I could ask. I don't know necessarily that, I think I need to get some tools onto some wood. And then I think that the questions are going to really start flowing. I think that you summarized it, and I, like, you really did a great job. You've give us a lot to look up, study up on. I think you did paint a pretty clear picture. At least to me, hopefully everybody sort of was able to get a lot out of those details that you gave us there. Again, I would just refer everybody to the places Shane mentioned earlier, but also to his Art of Bow Hunting page. There's lots of really cool little clips and things on self bows, bow making and such.
And even if this just gets the wheels turning in people's minds, it may not be a perfectly clear process while after listening to this, but at least gets your wheels turning, and it kind of gives you an idea of what's involved. And then you can go, like you said, dive into the resources and get more detailed information. A really good forum for information, just, people building a ton of beautiful, absolute masterpiece works of art. A lot of bows is a forum called Primitive Archer. And there's just a lot of great knowledge on there. People have been building bows for a long, long time. And that's a great resource. You can post, if you're wondering if your tiller looks good, you can post a picture of it and you'll get people's feedback and say, oh, it looks a little stiff in this spot, looks a little, bending too much here. And it's a great resource.
I find with drawing, it'll look fine, it'll look great, but if I take a photo of it and then look at the photo, I don't know what it is. It's a photograph of exactly the same thing I'm looking at. But in the original, I might not see certain proportions out, but on the photograph, it'll jump right out at me. I don't know if that would be at all applicable to bow making, but that is something I do a lot when I draw, is I'll take a photo of my drawing and I will use my photo as sort of...
Yeah, that helps a lot. You can pick out, or video, a video of you drawing the bow, whether it's on the tree, the tillering tree, or... just when you're drawing it in your hand, photos can tell you a lot. For some reason, they just, whether it's that smaller screen or what it is, but it's they do great at showing.
Your flaws just become apparent. It is a strange thing.
Another thing that I really like to do is because, when you have it on a tillering stick, it gives you a pretty accurate representation of how it bends, but realistically, it's going to be bending in your hand when you're holding it. So what I like to do is, if you have a big mirror, I like to stand in front of the mirror, hold the bow in my hand, and draw it back a bunch of times in the mirror, watching how the limbs are bending in that mirror when you're actually holding it, because that's how it's going to be shot in your hand. And sometimes it bends a little different in your hand than it does on the tillering tree. So a good... big mirror is a great way to check your tiller.
Well, I think that's definitely a good little starter for anybody interested in bow making. So maybe we'll leave it at that. Thanks for listening. And
had a great time again. I'm enjoying these podcasts.
They're a lot of fun. It gives us an excuse to get together too. But yeah, we're going to get out to another 3D shoot. I'm going to start making a bow here. And stay tuned. Next week, we'll come at you with some more great info.
See you later, guys. Have a good week.
Bye.
Four. Been delayed 0.0 week or more. What do they do?